My name is also David, so I'm David too. As we look on the Monday night blue chip speakers meeting, we look at this as the reading is based on a passage from book from page 29 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal story is described in our own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening to the speaker on the AA Blue Chip Speakers organization. If you want to get this back, you go to on the computer aabluechipspeakers.org, and you can get this and listen to it again. Desperately in need, and we need to hear our speaker. We believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I'd like to, now my honor to introduce tonight's speaker, Paul O. Now, Paul is a rare individual. He's sober, and he can tell you more about what he was. But the reason he's a rare individual, because we co-sponsor each other. And so he's had his work cut out for him. I mean, any time you tie up with a crazy half-breed Indian and trying to help keep him sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, you've done a job. But he's been a very blessed part of my life. And I have to say one thing on a personal, professional basis. For the first time in my life, I found myself confronted with an issue about my surviving my spouse of 62 years. And the only person I could think to talk to was my co-sponsor, Paul O. And let me tell you, he had plenty of answers. He's real close to us, and he's real close to AA. And he's real. This program is his part of his life and a major part of his life. I introduce Paul O. tonight.
Thanks, David. I feel like saying, okay, pass the baskets, we're done, but we already did that. I'm Paul, I'm an alcoholic. I'm very grateful to be here sober and very grateful to have David Newberry as my sponsor. He insists we're co-sponsors, and I, in deference to him, I let him get by with that. But this program is kind of like that. We help each other along. I didn't know that when I came in. I tended to put my sponsor on a pedestal, have him be my one and only higher power, and then when they would act like a human, I would be sorely disappointed and have to do some step work about it. So I guess that's the reason for all that. My AA pedigree. My sobriety date is March 20th, 1991. I do have a sponsor who you just met. I do sponsor guys. And I have a home group, the early morning study group. I also attend the 545 How It Works group. I tend to go to literature-based meetings because I have the kind of mind that, left to its own devices, will think of its own things, and without me ever intending it, I become my own higher power again. And how did that happen? So I've also been told that if I don't forget what it was like and what happened, I won't have to go do a replay or relive it again. So I try to stay here and not have to come back here. I like the thing at the beginning. It's a good reminder for me. Our stories disclose in a general way what we're like, what happened, and what we're like now. I remember the first time I told my story, I had about 6 months sober, and I got asked to tell my story at Peachford Hospital at one of their big wing dings. And I nearly died of a panic attack. They say you can't, but I nearly did. And I talked for an hour and 20 minutes. They finally gave me the hook, literally off the stage. And I was about 4 years into my drinking. So that was my first attempt. I promise I won't do that tonight. But the whole purpose of this thing, I think it's good for me, and that it helps me sort of remember what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and be grateful for that. It also helps me be of service. So one thing I've learned over the years telling my story is I will do my best to not try and be witty, charming, clever, profound, any of that stuff. I'll just try and be me and say what it was like. everyone who's here has to make their own decision about getting here and about staying here. And that's one thing that's kind of confounding about this program, because part of me wanted to come to a place, part of me totally didn't, still with a plug in the jug, I didn't want to be told what to do and what not to do. But the part of me that the first step took, I put it that way, I didn't take the first step, it took me, and I was still alive by grace to be taken by it, was that I didn't have another idea left in me. That's what my bottom was like. We all have different kinds of bottoms. I literally could not think another thought about how to keep drinking. I just ran out of steam, and again, by grace, I was still alive. There was more alcohol downstairs where I was. I was by myself. There was nobody to stop me. I just couldn't do it anymore. And then I also told myself, I don't know how to not do it anymore. When you think about that, it's really both parts of the first step. I can't do it, and I don't know how not to. So that I try and keep that moment, even though it was a while ago, very green and very near and dear to me. Now, for me, if that's all there was to recovery, was just remember how bad it was, keep the plug in the jug, and if there's anybody who's doing it that way, no disrespect. There's no one true way or 10 true ways of doing this. We all do it our own way. But I have found that it's so much more than that most days. Some days it's just, okay, how do I not drink today? And I haven't had one whole day like that in a while, but I've had moments like that. I actually had one on Saturday, and I hadn't had even a passing thought. I was with my wife and my two youngest grandkids up at Chattanooga, and because of my work schedule, we had to cram three big events into like a day and a half. So a four-year-old and a seven-year-old going to the zoo, and then going to the aquarium, and then going to the Children's Museum. And at the Children's Museum, I had a flashback to Austin, Texas, when I was accompanying a friend of mine with his daughter, who was 3 or 4 years old, and I was a godfather, and we went to Chuck E. Cheese, which when you're drinking is like hell on earth. You know, all you can do is just look, it still may be, but just pound beers. Well, here I was in a similar kind of place, and I thought, you know, a lot of these people look like they could use a drink. You know, I wonder what that would be like. And I was like, whoa, you know, stop that right there. So then I mindfully got into the moment. Anyway. So, a lot of lessons in sobriety. I'm not going to do a big biography, but I think part of the identification, you know, we learned to identify, not compare, is telling you a little bit about myself. I was born in 1952. Do the math. Next birthday will be that coveted, you know, cakes with Social Security, Medicare cards on it and all that stuff. But you know what? I'm grateful that it beats the alternative to have died at age 39, which is how old I was when the first step took me. I'm the youngest of two children. My father and mother that I know of weren't alcoholics. My father's father was an alcoholic of our type and then some. He died in the streets of Boston at age 52 of active alcoholism. He would disappear for a year or two, come home, beat my grandmother, beat my father, who was the oldest of four children. Though the first few times he came home, he was the only child, and then he was the oldest of two, and then he was the oldest of three, and then the oldest of four. My grandfather would come home, beat people, get my grandmother pregnant, and disappear. He was a rare breed. He was reportedly a draft dodger from Sweden. Now, Sweden is pretty damn neutral. So to be a draft dodger from Sweden, you have to be ultra neutral. This guy just did not want to fight. So he emigrated instead. And my mother, her grandmother, came over in her teens, too. So we have that Scandinavian be by yourself, think about it, brood, find some vodka, think about it some more, brood kind of streak going on. Now, on my mother's side, there was some Irish stuff going on. So, you know, by genetic predisposition, I was kind of poised, but I was yet an empty test tube because we hadn't added the alcohol. Something happened when I was about 5 or 6 years old. I lived a very idyllic life out on the far end of Long Island in New York, right on the beach, the North Shore. Friends, black lab dog, riding bikes, just I was a happy little kid. And then my father, who was a school teacher, got a promotion. to a suburb of Westchester County, New York, where and back in the 50s, teachers really didn't make money. So this was a big deal for him. So I was the last person in the family told about it. So he told his little happy, playing with his friends, black lab, swimming in the Long Island Sound, kid, we're moving to near the city, and I apparently pitched a fit, and apparently he had gotten a cool reception from my mother. My sister was all for it, as she was 4 years older than me and already couldn't wait to get out of the sticks where she thought we lived. And so my father kind of lost it a little. He certainly didn't beat me, but he gave me a thorough spanking, which he was not inclined to do. And, you know, they say about us as alcoholics that we tend to be, there's three descriptors that always get nods in meeting when they're read: childish, emotionally sensitive, and grandiose. For whatever reason, I was already those three things. So when I got that spanking, I literally decided, and I can remember it like it just happened, I'm going to be a stoic. I read a picture book about stoics. I'm not going to feel any emotions. I'm not only not going to show them, I'm not going to have them. I'm not going to have anger. I'm not going to have fear. I didn't know by doing that, in effect, you're also dampening down your joy, your other things. It would be great if we could just damp down the ones we don't like or are afraid of and keep the other ones, but I didn't know that. So I did it, and we tend to be strong-willed. Would you say that's a pretty common denominator among alcoholics? And oh, by the way, I'm an ANDA. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I dropped the ANDA after about 3 or 4 million years of saying "and an addict," particularly here where some of the old-timers like Roland and those people where I like to really, a guy named Don, another guy. But it's part of my story, and I won't, as I talk about it later on, I won't get lost in that stuff, but it is part of my story. I discovered later on, after my second, fourth, and fifth step, that I really like stimulants, mainly cocaine, but if a little that wasn't around, methamphetamine would be okay too. The reason I liked those so much was because I could stay awake and drink longer, because my true love was alcohol. While other people were getting drunk and tired and falling out, I was in day two, day three, let's keep going. What are you, wimps? Come on. And I was also born with a high tolerance, which I thought was a blessing, turned out to be a mixed bag at best later on. So anyway, I'm a stoic. I also discovered later on, a lot of this is hindsight, because actually growing up and in my adulthood up to age 39 and a couple of years into sobriety, I was pretty clueless about who I really was. I started thinking that I needed to be what other things said I should be. So it might be a movie, it might be a song, it might be I tried not to go for stupid, obvious stuff, but spaghetti westerns, Clint Eastwood. I really wanted to be that guy. He was so alone, he didn't even have a name. He didn't even need a name. That was awesome. I don't want a name. But at the same time, I'm a biological human being, a man. I wanted to have some connections, too. So I had this thing going on all the time. I desperately wanted it. What I would hear all the time from girlfriends, serial, mostly monogamous. Occasionally there was some overlap, which was unfortunate. But mostly I'd be with one person. And after 6 months, 7 months, they would get about this close, and then would come the talk. I would see it coming, because we learned to read other people's nose hairs and anticipate. Oh, here comes the talk. You know, I get close to you, but I can only get this close. And then there's like I run into some kind of wall, and I'm already thinking, okay, so let's see, whose name is on the lease? Let's see, how much long, those kind of plans. Like, somebody's got to get out of here. Once or twice, they beat me to the punch, and they left first, and I would be, like, mortally wounded, and I would respond by spending the whole weekend by myself drinking over it. That's a good way to deal with those feelings. So, in terms of relationships, I want them, and I can't have them. I want to be close. I can't be close. I want to be something. I don't know what that is and who that is. Who I am, I don't really know. I was told fairly frequently, yeah, you're fairly intelligent. You should do something with that. I had the grandiosity to sort of want to hear that, but what I heard because I was already running off a big fuel of self-centered fear. And by the way, I haven't even met alcohol yet on all this. This is the fuel I'm running off of. Is that's a crushing responsibility. I want you to tell me I'm smart, but I don't want you to tell me I'm smart, because then I got to do something with it. And my self-centered fear tells me that I can't maintain that. Another thing I discovered about myself, and nobody gave me this idea, it wasn't my parents, it wasn't the church, it wasn't anything that I'm aware of. I discovered my basic schema from soon after becoming a Stoic at age 6 was this: I'm all alone in the universe and I'm not enough. I'm all alone and I'm not enough. I was never an atheist, but I was damn sure an agnostic, because for me, A, without gnosis, knowledge, anything I didn't think I could intellectually understand, I couldn't believe in. So here I am, by myself, running off this fuel of self-centered fear, being told I'm intelligent, sort of wanting to hear it, can't handle it. I discovered a way of coping with that. I became a classic underachiever. Expectations were high. I would start out there and I would work my way down the food chain. But I also discovered at the end of high school another gift I had, which was I was never a fearless rebel. I never said, you know, forget all this, I'm leaving it behind. I would sort of leave, but I'd always keep one foot inside the circle. So when I went to college, the first college I went to was against everybody's wishes, my parents, the dean, everybody but mine, Bard College, a little liberal arts college on the Hudson River. Those of you who like the band Steely Dan, that song My Old School is about Bard College, because they were proud, not alums, I don't think they graduated either. They've never gone back to their old school. I made it a semester and a half. There was one class I took, contemporary Russian literature, that I bought the books, but I never went to one class because the books were just too depressing. Well, I didn't know they were. I didn't actually read them, but they looked like they were depressing. Okay, that's the kind of dabbler, dilettante, you know, smarty guy I was. Yeah, this looks depressing, I'm not going to read them. So I dropped out with my friend Zev and went out to the other coast, right at the end of a tough state New York winter. And we went out there, and a couple of things happened on the way. And one of them actually, I think, had a lasting impact on me. I finally got some therapy done on it. We were hitchhiking, and we had on the New Jersey or Pennsylvania Turnpike, we picked up a little 16-year-old runaway who I named Susie Good Vibes. This is like 1970, so you have to consider the context. Zap comics, all that stuff. We protected her, but we got picked up by a trucker in Iowa after standing out there a long time on the edge of a cornfield. And when we all woke up, we were in the cabin of his tractor. And I was closest to him, and I had a gun against my temple. And for a half an hour, he wanted me and my friend Zev to rape her while he took pictures, and we wouldn't do it. And I'm not claiming any virtue. I told him at one point, even if I wanted to, I can't. I physically can't do this. You got this gun here. And so I really confronted my own death, but I didn't do it in any kind of spiritual growth kind of way. Of course, here I am, I didn't get shot, I didn't die. We got let off. Her heart was broken. We went out to San Francisco, and she immediately called her parents and flew back to Pennsylvania. My friend Zev, who really was, you know, what was that? One of the Zev characters who, you know, was always happy. He just went off and sort of ran San Francisco for a while. And I really began drinking and drugging more heavily at that point. I never made that connection until later on, because it was the first time I really got confronted with that kind of reality. And the way I dealt with it was, of course, more drinks and more drugs. The first drink I had was at age 7, I think, right before we moved from Long Island. I got my dad a Dixie cup of beer, cheap beer, drank a little of it before I filled it back up and brought it out to him. Tasted horrible. I mean, cheap beer, bleh. But it had this chemical reaction in my brain that was like this warm salve over the top of my brain. And I noticed it, but I didn't know what it meant. I was like, wow. Huh. But I never forgot that. I mean, I just described that. I just sort of re-experienced it right now. I really started drinking seriously when I was 13. Went out back to that town with some friends. We borrowed, you could say stole, but somebody knew somebody who knew somebody's parents who owned a boat. and went out on a choppy Long Island Sound and drank a case of Drambuie and got gut-wrenchingly sick on the beach for like an hour. And there were four of us, three of us, as soon as we, you know, came to and rinsed off in the ocean, were planning about the next weekend, and one guy didn't. And one of the guys who was planning for the next weekend is my lifelong friend. We met when we were three. He made it into recovery about 7 years before I did. He's got 32 years clean and sober. The other guy, Jock McChrystal, I said his name, but he's dead. It's okay. Died of a heroin overdose at age 27, that magic age. And then the other guy, you know, house, picket fence, had a wife, had kids, had a nice life from what you can tell. So we, three out of four of us, you know, we're bound to keep doing it. So the first step, you can see I'm nowhere close to it. It wasn't really until my mid-20s, well, before I left, before I got out of college, I did that underachiever thing again where I could do a burst of activity right at the end. Like high school, I did enough to get into BART. Toward the end of undergrad school, the dean's office caught up with me and said, you have to declare a major. And I was taking simple rocks for jocks, you know, the really easy geology course. And we had a teacher who let us drink beer, smoke joints, standing out in the river, measuring river velocities in upstate New York. I mean, who wouldn't want that for a major? So that was my major. I'm going to be a geologist. Burst of activity, graduated cum laude with the BS, got a fellowship to go to grad school in Wyoming and got a master's in geology, where I got hired by an oil and gas company and went down to Houston, Texas, where I worked in a skyscraper by myself in an office making geologic maps, trying to convince company management once in a while to spend a few $100,000 or $1 million to drill a well. Didn't involve people, didn't involve anything I really believed in. I did really well. I got straight A's. I did all that stuff. But inside, I knew I had no idea what I was doing. I was a total phony and a fake. But remember, I'm all alone and I'm not enough, and I don't have anybody I can tell that to. So I just got to keep going on pretending to be okay. Well, what helps somebody like me do that? More and more alcohol and drugs. There was a bar across the street in downtown Houston from my skyscraper that I called the Recovery Room, and that name kind of stuck. Other people started calling it that, where I would go at lunchtime. And lunch began getting earlier and earlier, like sometimes an 11 o'clock lunch, occasionally a 10:45 lunch, which might last till 2. And as I walked in the door, I trained them to have my lunch set up. Three double vodkas and two spring egg rolls with extra spicy mustard sauce. I might have some refills if it was a long lunch and I was doing business, but since I was there by myself, I was doing business by thinking, being alone and drinking and thinking in a bar. And that was what I was doing to cope and deal and get through. So I decided, you know, this isn't working for me, but I made no connection with my drinking. When I was in grad school in Wyoming, I dated a law student and sort of on a lark took the law boards and did really well. So the month before it was going to run out and expire, I applied to law school and got in and went to law school at night. So I had a miserable job I hated by day, went to law school at night, brought alcohol with me, would bring a big cooler with, by then I changed, it's Houston, I'm drinking margaritas. Only I had a special recipe called Killeritas, which was a strong margarita that then I would pour like a quart of vodka into. And I would bring a cooler into law school. I thought that was normal, with ice, after a hard day of work at a job I hated, and drink my way through law school. Somehow I passed the bar, and all that Perry Mason I'd watched as a young boy. I hung out my own shingle as a defense lawyer, criminal defense lawyer. Some of the most wonderful and constantly terrifying moments of my life, because I had no support. I was out there on my own. Remember, I'm all alone. I'm not enough. I'm a fraud. I don't really know what's going on. I don't really know who I am. I'm making stuff up as I go. I'm living off my own wits and my own willpower. Does this sound familiar to anybody? And that's my steady diet. I mean, I live off adrenaline, fear, denial, stoicism, being witty, but really by this time my wit had totally gone to sarcasm, because that's a great protective shield. And you know, if people get upset about it, you can just what's your problem? I'm just kidding. You know, come on. And so I didn't learn about that until Into Recovery. That was actually the first big character defect I worked on. So here I am, trudging along into my 30s, mid-30s. I went down to court in Galveston because my shtick was some of the higher-powered attorneys would farm out their clients to me for the trouble they got into in the outlying provinces. Unless it was a heavy felony, I would go take care of it. And actually, I did pretty well for as impaired as I was in so many ways. I won more than I lost, which when you're a defense attorney is not bad. But again, I don't claim any credit for it. It was just sheer terror and that sort of perfectionistic drive to, you know, be, Bill talks about the top of the heap and the bottom of the heap at the same time. Everybody look at me, nobody notice me. Just crazy stuff. And it seemed normal. I thought, this is normal. This is how people live. Relationships began getting a little sketchier. I began dating not future Al-Anons, but future AA and CA and NA people. The Al-Anons had sort of given up on me. I wasn't a good project anymore. So I really had to go with women of my type. And so I got engaged to a woman over in San Antonio. How I ended up over there with her is I went to this routine court appearance in Galveston. It was like a reset motion. I mean, you can do it in your sleep. And I had a panic attack at the door of the courthouse, and I couldn't go in there. I was terrified to go in there. And I knew all the people. They were friendly. It had nothing to do with reality. It had everything to do with the progression of my disease, I think. Not only physically, but emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. I was becoming bankrupt. And so I did what any good alcoholic would do. I went down, this was pre-cell phone days, pre even those 20-pound mobile phone days. So I got to a payphone, found some quarters, called up, told a lie, said I had two blowouts on the way down. It's like two drinks, two blowouts, you know, not one, two. And I, you know, I have to reset. Oh, sure, we'll reset. And I didn't practice law yet. Driving back to Houston, I was thinking, how can I give away all my cases? I can't do that. But, you know, it's the classic alcoholic dilemma. Paul, you can't drink and practice law. Here's my law practice. I mean, it was a no-brainer. I had no idea that drinking and alcoholism were really a problem. A little clues occasionally, and I would cut back a little, like when I was starting for the law boards, which are the toughest test I've ever taken. I only, in the 8 weeks before it, I had like maybe three beers, and it was only three 12-ounce beers. It wasn't like three warehouses of beer or cases of beer. And I felt really good about that. It's a 2.5-day exam. Friday at 12:30, when the exam got out at 12:15, I was in the trunk of my car pouring out a giant go-cop of my best Killeritas that I'd made for that very occasion, and then drove down to a bar in downtown Houston where they had 3-for-1 happy hour, and actually got arrested. One of my two, over there they call it DWIs, and had to get sprung on Sunday by one of my classmates who saw my name on the roster and came and let me out. Did I say that was a problem? No. So now I'm in my 30s. I'm over in San Antonio. I'm really unemployable. But I'm trying, sort of, to find work. Living in a Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf relationship. We fought. We argued. We screamed. We never hit each other. But then we would make up, you know, furiously, and then we would do it all over again. And she worked, and I lived in her house and just felt worse and worse. So my father and sister intervened on me and on a telephone intervention and said, you know, last time we saw you at Christmas, you just seemed so unhappy. We're not saying anything. Just take a break. Just move back up with Dad and just sort things out. Just take a moment, sort things out. Well, they were sort of laying a little ambush for me, but I was a willing victim. I said, you know, I think you're right. I think I just need a breather. So I told Gretchen, I said, I'm going to ship a bunch of my stuff up to my dad's. It's cluttering up your house anyway. I'm going to get rid of the rest. I'll be back. And I really kind of meant it, as honestly as I could. And at age 37, I rode a Greyhound bus from San Antonio up to the New York Port Authority in the middle of the summer, the hottest day of the year. The air conditioning broke on the bus. The toilet was clogged up. It was like hell. It was 4 days of hell. But I didn't drink. And so I was kind of in withdrawal when I got up there, but feeling good about it. And then my dad and his girlfriend met me at the bus terminal, and we drove home. It wasn't a triumphant homecoming, but it was okay. They were being nice. And then the next day, my dad laid on and said, "By the way, son, a condition of your being here is you need to do something about your drinking. And I have this friend of mine who goes to AA." I'd never been to an AA meeting. I lied and told my father and sister once that I'd gone to one in San Antonio. I never went. Of course I was lying. I was protecting my drinking. I mean, that's justifiable lying. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I can win that case. I mean, come on. So I said, okay. So that night I drained his entire liquor cabinet. And then he refilled it. And then I drained it halfway and filled it up with water. And then I started going to AA, where I went for almost 2 years, a year and a half to 2 years. To the Hartsdale Ardsley group in Westchester County, New York. Bill Wilson had gone up there in his Packard sedan when he wanted to get away from the city and all that. Long history. My dad's friend became my sponsor, Bernie. And nobody ever judged me there. Now, I went to work for the same oil company again, but I went to work for them pumping gas on Central Avenue in Yonkers, New York. But within a week, with my keen alcoholic mind, I put myself in a position where they didn't like the manager of the place, so they fired him and made me the manager. And I think the statute of limitations is run from the IRS, but I got paid more under the table in cash money. It was a gas station repair shop doing that than it all but my best month as a lawyer. I mean, I made a lot of money. But what I really got to do was drink all day while telling my dad I was not drinking. Go to AA meetings every night. I would stop drinking about 5 o'clock, go to an 8 o'clock meeting. I had that brown, you know, horrible brown-looking shell uniform. I would start spilling oil and gas on it so I had good fumes coming out. Stop drinking at 5 o'clock, brush my teeth vigorously, scrape my tongue, gargle with stuff. I was drinking. I graduated to pop-off vodka at this point because, A, it was priced right, and also it had that plastic half-gallon that would fit under your seat really well. You know, the glass ones wouldn't fit, but this would. And I had some backup supply hidden in a case of Shell Fire and Ice oil. Of course, every gas station manager has to have that in case of emergency. That was in case they found all my stashes. They certainly wouldn't look in there. I couldn't rinse all the oil out, so it also had a good effect on my GI system. I preferred 30W-40 weight to 10W-40. It was, you know, this is an alcoholic at age 38 and 39. My whole life had become organized around drinking. So when the first step took me, sitting on those stairs, my dad came home a couple days afterwards. He had gone on vacation. I was supposed to go back to Texas to take some law continuing education courses to keep my license current. Instead, when I heard he was going on vacation, I just blew that off and drove around and bought all the vodka I could find and holed myself up in his house and drank for pretty much a week around the clock. I won't give you all the details of it. I will say there was a televangelist who was on who one Sunday morning, well, I will tell you, Robert Schuller. Whatever you think about him, I think he saved my life because by funny coincidence or God shot or whatever you want to call it, the sermon was, I know you're out there. I know you're by yourself. I know you're being consumed by alcohol and drugs. And I know that there is hope for you and there's a way for you. And of course, you know, delusional, psychotic, no sleep. I couldn't sleep more than an hour without going into withdrawal severe enough to wake up and drink some more so I could pass out for an hour. But he was like coming out of the TV talking to me. And I think that kept me going to that point where I was up on the stairs. So I go into a detox. I started to go to the detox. We had to wait for 2 days for bed. And actually, at the sign-in desk at the hospital, I went into a full-blown case of DTs. And so they skipped all the registration stuff and called the code. And I came to like four days later coming out with IVs and all the stuff they do. But I was alive. And I had actually gone to that place when I was drinking and pretending not to. I had taken some step meetings into that detox unit. So here I was on the other side of the table. But I was done. I was done. And I've stayed done since then. And not of my own doing. unfortunate, and it's not the only way to do it. I actually came to Georgia only because it was the number one place on a list of five recommended by that detox up there, the treatment program, Decatur Hospital in Decatur, Georgia. Back then, it wasn't owned by DeKalb Medical, where I work now at that point. They had a really good treatment program. And I went in there for 30 days, and when I got out of there, it was springtime, and, you know, Claremont Road in the springtime was just beautiful. I hadn't developed allergies yet. It was my life. My life was coming back into bloom. It was like, I need to be in Atlanta. And my dad loved me, but he was okay with me moving to Atlanta. He had to buy a new couch. They couldn't clean the old one with all the vodka fumes where I passed out on the couch while lying to him. But he really loved me. He never stopped loving me, and he believed in me. My sister never stopped loving me, but she was really mad at me for about 3 or 4 years because I'd lied to her too. I had called her up in the middle of the night sometimes with those, you know, 2 a.m. epiphany phone calls, like, Betty, I've got it. If you could just loan me $800, I can fly to Australia and I can become a bartender over there, and my whole life's going to turn around. Click. Yeah. So that was part of my amends when I had to talk to her. So they said do 90 and 90s. I did like 360. I mean, I did a lot of meetings. I did 30 to 40 meetings a week. I was still unemployable. I had a little bit of savings left from my law stuff, and I lived in a halfway house, not one of the high-end ones, but one down off Candle Road. It was a place called Recoup, and that's where I met my second sponsor, Jewel Lassiter, who took me through the steps a second time. I promoted my first sponsor to sponsor emeritus when he moved in with me to be my roommate, because my sense of boundaries was violated. We can be roommates, but you can't be my sponsor. But I loved him anyway. And Jewel was just amazing to me. I was around when the heavy hitters got started. And so I was part of that whole thing. Some of my friends know this. My nickname, not loving at all, in the halfway house was Captain Recovery. Because I was all about, let's have a step meeting, and they were all about, let's play spades and go chase some women and pretend like we're going to a meeting. And I, you know, no! I was just grim. I wore sobriety like a shrunken wetsuit with a suit of armor over it. I mean, but, you know, I didn't mean to, but I had to have this thing. And I would rather go that way and learn to ease off a little bit as we go rather than, you know, start off slow and I'll catch up later. And that's still part of who I am. I don't go to 90 and 90s. I did that in my first 4 or 5 years. They say get a home group. I got four at one point, and somebody told me, AA doesn't actually have any rules. They have suggestions, but can you imagine how hard it is trying to have an accurate number of how many people are in AA, and you're like counting for four people and you're only one person? I could sort of understand that. So I went back to one. My first home group was Friday Night Frights, when it was an hour and a half, 2 hour meeting, and we smoked, chain smoked the whole time and loved it. I mean, go figure. And shared like endlessly, like I can still do. Trying to work on that still. But then I went to the Bridge Builders group for a while, and then the 545 I've always gone to, the 930 group before there was the 730 morning group. I saw somebody with a resentment and a coffee pot and a better idea stomp out of the 930 and start the 730, and it took hold. I was there for the open the curtain wars versus keep the curtains closed and keep it a small meeting wars. I'm the one who introduced the motion that finally passed, that we opened the curtains, and then nearly got into, David was here for this, nearly got into a deadly fight over it with one of the opponent's main sponsorees, a big guy who had real anger management problems, who would have killed me. And I was back in that corner looking around for something I could break so I could kill him, because we were arguing about the tense tradition and outside issues. I mean, tell me the insanity goes away when you put the plug in the jug. We think, no, I really was, he's going to kill me. I'm going to have to kill him. Wait a minute. David and Larry Klinger and some people intervened. And that next Monday, I sat down with the guy and made amends. And actually, he and I became really good friends and shared some stuff later on. So Magnificent Loner began to learn how to do things a little bit differently. Second step, I discovered that I'm actually a really spiritual person. And I think still when we read the big book, We Agnostics is my favorite chapter, because it just speaks to me I can go into any, pretty much any church. No offense to anybody. I'm a little iffy on the like Pentecostal snake handling tongue stuff. I'm a little uncomfortable with that, but I could even go in there. Well, maybe not with the snakes. I mean, I'll have to come in there with like a warthog or, you know, some, a mongoose or something like that. Then maybe I'll go in. But I can go anywhere, but it's spiritual for me. So I'm kind of ecumenical without that being a vague. I honor and respect all kinds of religions and can go there and find the same stuff we learned here. Identify, don't compare. Look for what's really there, the substance. And I found out, you know, I'd actually been spiritual my whole life. I just picked the wrong higher power. I picked alcohol, drugs, my own wits and my own willpower, running off a fuel of self-centered fear. Bad pick, but who knew it? It seemed to work in the moment. It was anesthesia. It was the thing that made me feel a little bit more comfortable in my skin. It was the thing that made me feel a little more confident. It was the thing that helped me with dating and with dancing and with lovemaking and with all kinds of, you know, social activities that we do. It helped me do that because it helped me tamp down that self-centered fear. But guess what else it did? It kept me from learning any other way of doing it. That became my go-to thing. And then we all know the story. It's actually, I think, 17-syllable haiku. A man takes a drink, then a drink takes a drink, then the drink takes the man. That's the shorthand of the progression. And at the end, near the end, I had a girlfriend before things went really bad when I was living with my dad. And the last thing I remember her, she was younger than me. She was cute. She was funny. She was a geologist. She was enamored of me. I helped her car get fixed. She was just lovely. And it was her banging on both doors and all the windows saying, "I know you're in there. I know you're in there. Come out. We can go out. We can have fun. We can have a life together." And I was in a corner of the living room, totally in the dark, with drapes pulled over me, drinking out of my half gallon of vodka with, of course, that pore restrictor pulled out. That was always the first thing to go. Yes, you can do that with just flip it with a thumb. Like, that's a waste of everybody's time. By myself, sobbing. I kid you not. That's what I was doing when this beautiful, spiritual, lovely creature was out there wanting me to come out and play, and I was in there by myself drinking. That's where alcoholism took me. Tell me it's not a physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual malady. I won't argue with you, but for me it is. So, in recovery, I have gotten to be married 18 years and a half years to somebody who I actually dated and then went steady with. Well, then we moved in after that. But hey, it was a couple of years. It wasn't the classic alcoholic story of day two, somebody's getting a U-Haul. You know, we're moving in together. We're planning the whole rest of our lives together. I have an incredible family who love me. I have people all over my life who love me. My main issue now in sobriety is it's sort of the flip side. One of my favorite Tom Petty songs when I was drinking, it was one of my anthems in Wyoming when I was driving up and down to the top of the mountain to go drink and drug with the Hell's Angels guys, was "Too Much Ain't Enough" by Tom Petty. Too much ain't enough of the good stuff in sobriety either, but I can use acceptance on that and not have to be greedy with it. There's another Tom Petty song line that I'll give you, and then I'll read one quote and then I'll wrap it up. It's a song called King's Highway, and there's this line just really gets me every time I hear it. I don't want to end up in a room all alone. I don't want to end up someone I don't even know. And that was really the story of my life. I had no idea who I was, and that's how I ended up. Now, you know, it's step 12 of the 12 and 12. On page 124 and 125, it says this: "Still more wonderful is the feeling that we do not have to be especially distinguished among our fellows in order to be usefully and profoundly happy. Not many of us can be leaders of prominence, nor do we wish to be. Service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help. The knowledge that at home or in the world outside, we are partners in a common effort. The well-understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important. The proof that love freely given surely brings a full return. The certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons." That's my tune. "The surety that we no longer need to be square pegs and round holes, but can fit in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living, for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. These next two lines are really my job description, my life job description, I think, for me. True ambition is not what we thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. And that's what I try and do today. So thank you for your listening.
Thanks, Paul. We have asked Julie to come up and pass out the chips.
I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. What a pleasure and a privilege to be able to give out the chips after telling that story. I just adore you. When I was brand new in sobriety, he had 4 years, so you know I thought he was a god, and kind of still do. And I had to go to a party for my husband's work, and I was terrified. And I'm in this party, and I look across the room, and there's Paul and John, Locksmith John, I call him. I was like, what the hell are they doing here? But it was like God had put these people in this party to calm me down and let me be at this party. I'll never forget that. I started hearing like their neighbor, since I can't remember why you were there, but I was really glad you were. But this is not my story. I'm giving out the chips. I forgot. We have a chip system. And we have a white chip for anybody who's coming in for the first time or coming back after some experimentation. Anybody? All right. We have a silver chip for 30 days. Do you have 30 days? We have a red chip for 90 days. Anybody? We have a yellow chip for 6 months. Yay, chip! Have a green, anybody else for 6 months? Have a green chip for 9 months? Anybody? How about a blue chip for birthdays?
I'm Chris, I'm an alcoholic. I'm here on vacation with my family from North Augusta. Many sleepless nights, many more pieces of humble pie, and just to following y'all's suggestions. It's God's grace. And I knew y'all be here for me. Thanks.
Anybody else have a year, Michael? How about anybody we consider on a white chip? Anyone? Congratulations, you guys. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting tonight. Just can't.
circumstance.